Lunch at the Gotham Cafe. One day I came home from the brokerage house where I worked and found a letter, more of a note actually, from my wife on the dining room table. It said she was leaving me, that she was pursuing a divorce, that I would hear from her lawyer. I sat on the chair at the kitchen end of the table, reading this communication over and over again, not able to believe it. After a while, I got up, went into the bedroom, and looked in the closet. All her clothes were gone except for one pair of sweatpants and a joke sweatshirt someone had given her with the words, "Rich Blonde," printed on the front in spangly stuff. I went back to the dining room table, which was actually at one end of the living room. It was only a four-room apartment, and read the six sentences over again. It was the same, but looking into the half-empty bedroom closet had started me on the way to believing what it said. It was a chilly piece of work, that note. There was no love or good luck or even best at the bottom of it. "Take care of yourself" was as warm as it got. Just below that, she had scratched her name, Diane. I walked into the kitchen, poured myself a glass of orange juice, then knocked it onto the floor when I tried to pick it up. The juice sprayed onto the lower cabinets and the glass broke. I knew I would cut myself if I tried to pick up the glass. My hands were shaking, but I picked it up anyway, and I cut myself. Two places, neither deep. I kept thinking that it was a joke, then realizing it wasn't. Diane wasn't much of a joker. But the thing was, I didn't see it coming. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know if that made me stupid or insensitive. As the days passed, and I thought about the last 6 or 8 months of our 2-year marriage, I realized I had been both. That night, I called her folks in Pound Ridge and asked if Diane was there. "She is, and she doesn't want to talk to you," her mother said. "Don't call back." The phone went dead in my ear. 2 days later, I got a call at work from Diane's lawyer, who introduced himself as William Humboldt, and after ascertaining that he was indeed speaking to Stephen Davis, began calling me Steve. I suppose that's a little hard to believe, but it's what happened. Lawyers are so bizarre. Humboldt told me I would be receiving preliminary paperwork early the following week and suggested I prepare an account overview prefatory to dissolving your domestic corporation. He also advised me not to make any sudden fiduciary movements and suggested that I keep all receipts for items purchased, even the smallest, during this financially difficult passage. Last of all, he suggested that I find myself a lawyer. "Listen a minute, would you?" I asked. I was sitting at my desk with my head down and my left hand curled around my forehead. My eyes were shut so I wouldn't have to look into the bright gray socket of my computer screen. I'd been crying a lot, and my eyes felt like they were full of sand. "Of course," he said. "Happy to listen, Steve. I've got two things for you. First, you mean preparatory to ending your marriage, not prefatory to dissolving your domestic corporation. And if Diane thinks I'm going to try and cheat her out of what's hers, she's wrong." "Yes," Humboldt said, not indicating agreement, but that he understood my point. "Second, you're her lawyer, not mine. I find you calling me by my first name patronizing and insensitive. Do it again on the phone and I'll hang up on you. Do it to my face, and I'll probably try to punch your lights out. Steve, Mr. Davis, I hardly think..." I hung up on him. It was the first thing I'd done that gave me any pleasure since finding that note on the dining room table, with her 3 apartment keys on top of it to hold it down. That afternoon, I talked to a friend in the legal department, and he recommended a friend of his who did divorce work. The divorce lawyer was John Ring, and I made an appointment with him for the following day. I went home from the office as late as I could, walked back and forth through the apartment for a while, decided to go out to a movie, couldn't find anything I wanted to see, tried the television, couldn't find anything there to look at either, and did some more walking. And at some point, I found myself in the bedroom, standing in front of an open window 14 floors above the street, and chucking out all my cigarettes, even the stale old pack of Viceroys from the very back of my top desk drawer, a pack that had probably been there for 10 years or more, since before I had any idea there was such a creature as Diane Coslaw in the world, in other words. Although I'd been smoking between 20 and 40 cigarettes a day for 20 years, I don't remember any sudden decision to quit, nor any dissenting interior opinions, not even a mental suggestion that maybe 2 days after your wife walks out is not the optimum time to quit smoking. I just stuffed the full carton, the half carton, and the two or three half-used packs I found lying around out the window and into the dark. Then I shut the window. It never once occurred to me that it might have been more efficient to throw the user out instead of the product. It was never that kind of situation. Laid down on my bed and closed my eyes. As I drifted off, it occurred to me that tomorrow was probably going to be one of the worst days of my life. It further occurred to me that I would probably be smoking again by noon. I was right about the first thing, wrong about the second. The next 10 days, the time during which I was going through the worst of the physical withdrawal from nicotine, were difficult and often unpleasant, but perhaps not as bad as I thought they would be. And although I was on the verge of smoking dozens, no, hundreds, of times, I never did. There were moments when I thought I would go insane if I didn't have a cigarette. And when I passed people on the street who were smoking, I felt like screaming, "Give that to me, motherfucker! That's mine!" at them. But I didn't. For me, the worst times were late at night. I think, but I'm not sure. All my thought processes from around the time Diane left me are very blurry in my mind. I had an idea that I would sleep better if I quit, but I didn't. I lay awake some mornings until 3, hands laced together under my pillow, looking up at the ceiling, listening to sirens and to the rumble of trucks headed downtown. At those times, I would think about the 24-hour Korean market almost directly across the street from my building. I would think about the white fluorescent light inside, so bright it was almost like a Kubler-Ross near-death experience, and how it spilled out onto the sidewalk between the displays which, in another hour, the two young Korean men in white paper hats would begin to fill with fruit. I would also think about the older man behind the counter, also Korean, also in a paper hat, and the formidable racks of cigarettes behind him, as big as the stone tablets Charlton Heston brought down from Mount Sinai in the Ten Commandments. I would think about getting up, dressing, going over there, getting a pack of cigarettes, or maybe 9 or 10 of them, and sitting by the window, smoking one Marlboro after another, as the sky lightened to the east and the sun came up. I never did, but on many early mornings I went to sleep counting cigarette brands instead of sheep. Winston 100, Virginia Slims, Doral, Merit 100s, Camels, Camel Filters, Camel Lights. Later, around the time I was starting to see the last 3 or 4 months of our marriage in a clearer light, as a matter of fact, I began to understand that my decision to quit smoking when I did was perhaps not so unconsidered as it first seemed, and a very long way from ill-considered. I'm not a brilliant man, not a brave one either, but that decision might have been both. It's certainly possible. Sometimes we rise above ourselves. In any case, it gave my mind something concrete to pitch upon in the days after Diane left. It gave my misery a vocabulary it would not otherwise have had, if you see what I mean. Very likely you don't, but I can't think of any other way to put it. Of course, I have speculated that quitting when I did may have played a part in what happened at the Gotham Cafe that day, and I'm sure there's some truth to that. But who can foresee such things? None of us can predict the final outcomes of our actions, and few of us even try. Most of us just do what we do to prolong a moment's pleasure or to stop the pain. And even when we act for the noblest reasons, the last link of the chain all too often drips with someone's blood. Humboldt called me again 2 weeks after the evening when I'd bombed West 83rd Street with my cigarettes, and this time he stuck with Mr. Davis as a form of address. He thanked me for the copies of various documents forwarded him through Mr. Ring and said that the time had come for all four of us to sit down to lunch. All four of us meant Diane. My heart speeded up in my chest, and I could feel a pulse tapping away in the wrist of the hand holding the telephone. There are a number of details to be worked out and a number of pertinent arrangements to be discussed, and this seems to be the time to put that process in work, Humboldt said. He chuckled fatly in my ear, like a repulsive adult giving a child some minor treat. It's always best to let some time pass before bringing the principals together, a little cooling-off period, but in my judgment, a face-to-face meeting at this time would facilitate. Let me get this straight, I said. You're talking about lunch, he said. The day after tomorrow? Can you clear that on your schedule? Of course you can, his voice said, just to see her again, to experience the slightest touch of her hand. Eh, Steve? I don't have anything for lunch Thursday anyhow, so that's not a problem. And I should bring my lawyer? The fat chuckle came again, shivering in my ear like something just turned out of a jello mold. I imagine Mr. Ring would like to be included, yes. Did you have a place in mind? I wondered for a moment who would be paying for this lunch, and then had to smile at my own naivete. I reached into my pocket for a cigarette and poked the tip of a toothpick under my thumbnail instead. I winced, brought the pick out, checked the tip for blood, saw none, and stuck it in my mouth. Humboldt had said something, but I had missed it. The sight of the toothpick had reminded me all over again that I was floating cigarette-less on the waves of the world. "Pardon me? I asked if you knew the Gotham Cafe on 53rd Street," he said, sounding a touch impatient now, "between Madison and Park." "No, but I'm sure I can find it." "Noon?" "Noon's fine," I said, and thought of telling him to tell Diane to wear the green dress with the little black speckles and the slit up the side. "I'll just check with my lawyer." It occurred to me that that was a pompous, hateful little phrase, one I couldn't wait to stop using. "Do that, and call me back if there's a problem." I called John Ring, who hemmed and hawed enough to justify his retainer, not outrageous but considerable, and then said he supposed a meeting was in order at this time. I hung up, settled back in front of my computer terminal, and wondered how I was possibly going to be able to meet Diane again without at least one cigarette beforehand. On the morning of our scheduled lunch, John Ring called and told me he couldn't make it and that I would have to cancel. "It's my mother," he said, sounding harried. "She fell down the damn stairs and broke her hip, up in Babylon. I'm leaving now for Grand Central. I'll have to take the train." He spoke in the tone of a man saying he'll have to go by camel across the Gobi. I thought for a second, jiggling a fresh toothpick between my fingers. Two used ones lay beside my computer terminal, the ends frayed. I was going to have to watch that. It was all too easy to imagine my stomach filling up with sharp little splinterettes. The replacement of one bad habit with another seems almost inevitable, I've noticed. "Stephen, are you there?" "Yes," I said. "I'm sorry about your mother, but I'm going to keep the lunch date." He sighed, and when he spoke, he sounded sympathetic as well as harried. "I understand that you want to see her, and that's the reason why you have to be very careful and make no mistakes. You're not Donald Trump, and she's not Ivana, but this isn't a no-faulter we've got here either, where you get your decree by registered mail. You've done very well for yourself, Stephen, especially in the last 5 years." "I know, but..." "And for 3 of those years," Ring overrode me, now putting on his courtroom voice like an overcoat, "Diane Davis was not your wife, not your live-in companion, and not by any stretch of the imagination your helpmate. She was just Diane Kozlov from Pound Ridge, and she did not go before you tossing flower petals or blowing a coronet." "No, but I want to see her." And what I was thinking would have driven him mad. I wanted to see if she was wearing the green dress with the black speckles, because she knew damned well it was my favorite. He sighed again. "I can't have this discussion, or I'm going to miss my train. There isn't another one until 1:20. "Go and catch your train." "I will, but first I'm going to make one more effort to get through to you. A meeting like this is like a joust. The lawyers are the knights. The clients are reduced, for the time being, to no more than squires, with Sir Barrister's lance in one hand and the reins of his horse in the other." His tone suggested that this was an old image and well-loved. What you're telling me is that, since I can't be there, you're going to hop on my nag and go galloping at the other guy with no lance, no armor, no faceplate, probably not even a jockstrap. I want to see her, I said. I want to see how she is, how she looks. Hey, without you there, maybe Humboldt won't even want to talk. Oh, wouldn't that be nice, he said, and came with a small, cynical laugh. I'm not going to talk you out of it, am I? No. All right, then. I want you to follow certain instructions. If I find out you haven't, and that you've gummed up the works, I may decide it would be simpler to just resign the case. Are you hearing me? I'm hearing you. Good. Don't yell at her, Stephen. That's big number one. Are you hearing that? Yes. I wasn't going to yell at her. If I could quit smoking 2 days after she had walked out and stick to it, I thought I could get through 100 minutes and 3 courses without calling her a bitch. Don't yell at him. That's number two. Okay? Don't just say okay. I know you don't like him, and he doesn't like you much either. He's never even met me. How can he have an opinion about me one way or another? Don't be dense, he said. He's being paid to have an opinion, that's how. So say okay like you mean it. Okay like I mean it. Better. But he didn't say it like he really meant it. He said it like a man who is checking his watch. Don't get into substantive matters, he said. Don't discuss financial settlement issues, not even on a what-would-you-think-if-I-suggested-this basis. If he gets pissed off and asks why you kept the lunch date if you weren't going to discuss nuts and bolts, tell him just what you told me, that you wanted to see your wife again. Okay. And if they leave at that point, can you live with it? Yes. I didn't know if I could or not, but I thought I could, and I knew that Ring wanted to catch his train. As a lawyer, your lawyer, I'm telling you that this is a bullshit move, and that if it backfires in court, I'll call a recess just so I can pull you out into the hall and say I told you so. Now, have you got that? Yes, say hello to your mother. Maybe tonight, Ring said, and now he sounded as if he were rolling his eyes. I won't get a word in until then. I have to run, Stephen. Okay. I hope she stands you up. I know you do. He hung up and went to see his mother up in Babylon. When I saw him next, a few days later, there was something between us that didn't quite bear discussion, although I think we would have talked about it if we had known each other even a little bit better. I saw it in his eyes, and I suppose he saw it in mine as well, the knowledge that if his mother hadn't fallen down the stairs and broken her hip, he might have wound up as dead as William Humboldt. I walked from my office to the Gotham Cafe, leaving at 11:15 and arriving across from the restaurant at 11:45. I got there early for my own peace of mind, to make sure the place was where Humboldt had said it was, in other words. That's the way I am and pretty much the way I've always been. Diane used to call it my obsessive streak when we were first married, but I think that by the end she knew better. I don't trust the competence of others very easily, that's all. I realize it's a pain-in-the-ass characteristic, and I know it drove her crazy, but what she never seemed to realize was that I didn't exactly love it in myself, either. Some things take longer to change than others, though, and some things you can never change, no matter how hard you try. The restaurant was right where Humboldt had said it would be, the location marked by a green awning with the words Gotham Cafe on it. A white city skyline was traced across the plate glass windows. It looked New York trendy. It also looked pretty unamazing, just one of the 800 or so pricey restaurants crammed together in Midtown. With the meeting place located and my mind temporarily set at rest, about that anyway, I was tense as hell about seeing Diane again and craving a cigarette like mad. I walked up to Madison and browsed in a luggage store for 15 minutes. Mere window shopping was no good. If Diane and Humboldt came from uptown, they might see me. Diane was liable to recognize me by the set of my shoulders and the hang of my topcoat even from behind, and I didn't want that. I didn't want them to know I'd arrived early. I thought it might look needy, even pitiable, so I went inside. I bought an umbrella I didn't need and left the shop at straight-up noon by my watch, knowing I could step through the door of the Gotham Cafe at 12:05. I stood under the awning for a moment, looking in. The place was bright, and I marked that down in its favor. I have an intense dislike for dark restaurants where you can't see what you're eating or drinking. The walls were white and hung with vibrant, impressionist drawings. You couldn't tell what they were, but that didn't matter. With their primary colors and broad, exuberant strokes, they hit your eyes like visual caffeine. I looked for Diane and saw a woman that might have been her, seated about halfway down the long room and by the wall. It was hard to say because her back was turned, and I don't have her knack of recognition under difficult circumstances. But the heavy-set, balding man she was sitting with certainly looked like a Humboldt. I took a deep breath, opened the restaurant door, and went in. There are two phases of withdrawal from tobacco, and I'm convinced that it's the second that causes most cases of recidivism. The physical withdrawal lasts 10 days to 2 weeks, and then most of the symptoms, sweats, headaches, muscle twitches, pounding eyes, insomnia, irritability, disappear. What follows is a much longer period of mental withdrawal. These symptoms may include mild to moderate depression, mourning, some degree of anhedonia, emotional flatness, in other words, forgetfulness, even a species of transient dyslexia. I know all this stuff because I read up on it. Following what happened at the Gotham Cafe, it seemed very important that I do that. I suppose you'd have to say that my interest in the subject fell somewhere between the land of hobbies and the kingdom of obsession. The most common symptom of phase two withdrawal is a feeling of mild unreality. Nicotine improves synaptic transferal and improves concentration, widens the brain's information highway, in other words. It's not a big boost and not really necessary to successful thinking, although most confirmed cigarette junkies believe differently. But when you take it away, you're left with a feeling, a pervasive feeling in my case, that the world has taken on a decidedly dreamy cast. It was also a little like being mildly stoned all the time, because the feeling was accompanied by a sense of helplessness and moral exhaustion, a feeling that things had to simply go on the way they were going, for good or for ill, because you, except of course it's me I'm talking about, were just too damn busy not smoking to do much of anything else. I'm not sure how much all of this bears on what happened, but I know it has some bearing, because I was pretty sure something was wrong with the maitre d' almost as soon as I saw him, and as soon as he spoke to me, I knew. He was tall, maybe 45, slim, in his tux at least, in ordinary clothes he would have been skinny, mustached. He had a leather-bound menu in one hand. He looked like battalions of maitre d's and battalions of fancy New York restaurants, in other words. Except for his bow tie, which was askew, and something on his shirt, a splotch just above the place where his jacket buttoned. It looked like either gravy or a glob of some dark jelly. Also, several strands of his hair stuck up defiantly in back, making me think of alfalfa in the old Little Rascals one-reelers. That almost made me burst out laughing. I was very nervous, remember, and I had to bite my lips to keep it in. "Yes, sir?" he asked as I approached the desk. All maitre d's in New York City have accents, but it is never one you can positively identify. A girl I dated in the mid-80s, one who did have a sense of humor, along with a fairly large drug habit, unfortunately, told me once that they all grew up on the same little island and hence all spoke the same language. "What language is it?" I asked her. "Snooty," she said. And I cracked up. This thought came back to me as I looked past the desk to the woman I'd seen while outside. I was now almost positive it was Diane, and I had to bite the insides of my lips again. As a result, Humboldt's name came out of me sounding like a half-smothered sneeze. The maitre d's high, pale brow contracted in a frown. His eyes bored into mine. I had taken them for brown as I approached the desk, but now they looked black. "Pardon, sir?" he asked. It came out sounding to me like, "Fuck you, Jack." His long fingers, as pale as his brow, concert pianist fingers they looked like, tapped nervously on the cover of the menu. The tassel sticking out of it like some sort of half-assed bookmark swung back and forth. Humboldt, I said. Party of three. I found I couldn't take my eyes off his bow tie, so crooked that the left side of it was almost brushing the shelf under his chin, and that blob on his snowy white dress shirt. Now that I was closer, it didn't look like either gravy or jelly. It looked like partially dried blood. He was looking down at his reservations book, the rogue tuft at the back of his head waving back and forth over the rest of his slicked down hair. I could see his scalp through the grooves his comb had laid down, and a speckle of dandruff on the shoulders of his tux. It occurred to me that a good head waiter might have fired an underling put together in such sloppy fashion. Ah, yes, monsieur. He had found the name. Your party is... He was starting to look up. He stopped abruptly, and his eyes sharpened even more, if that was possible, as he looked past me and down. You cannot bring that dog in here, he said sharply. How many times have I told you you cannot bring that dog in here? He didn't quite shout, but spoke so loudly that several of the diners closest to his pulpit-like desk stopped eating and looked around curiously. I looked around myself. He had been so emphatic that I expected to see somebody's dog, but there was no one behind me, and most certainly no dog. It occurred to me then, I don't know why, that he was talking about my umbrella, that perhaps on the island of the maitre d's, dog was a slang term for umbrella, especially when carried by a patron on a day when rain did not look likely. I looked back at the maitre d' and saw that he had already started away from his desk, holding my menu in his hands. He must have sensed that I wasn't following, because he looked back over his shoulder, eyebrows slightly raised. There was nothing on his face now but polite inquiry. Are you coming, monsieur? And I came. I knew something was wrong with him, but I came. I could not take the time or effort to try and decide what might be wrong with the maitre d' of a restaurant where I had never been before today and where I would probably never be again. I had Humboldt and Diane to deal with. I had to do it without smoking, and the maitre d' of the Gotham Café would have to take care of his own problems, dog included. Diane turned around, and at first I saw nothing in her face and her eyes but a kind of frozen politeness. Then, just below it, I saw anger, or thought I did. We'd done a lot of arguing during our last 3 or 4 months together, but I couldn't recall ever seeing the sort of concealed anger I sensed in her now, anger that was meant to be hidden by the makeup and the new dress, blue, no speckles, no slit up the side, and the new hairdo. The heavy-set man she was with was saying something, and she reached out and touched his arm. As he turned toward me, beginning to get to his feet, I saw something else in her face. She was afraid of me, as well as angry at me. And although she hadn't said a single word, I was already furious at her. Everything on her face and in her eyes was negative. She might as well have been wearing a closed until further notice sign on her forehead. I thought I deserved better. Of course, that may just be a way of saying I'm human. Monsieur, the maitre d' said, pulling out the chair to Diane's left. I barely heard him, and certainly any thought of his eccentric behavior and crooked bow tie had left my head. I think that even the subject of tobacco had briefly vacated my head for the first time since I'd quit smoking. I could only consider the careful composure of her face and marvel at how I could be angry at her and still want her so much it made me ache to look at her. Absence may or may not make the heart grow fonder, but it certainly freshens the eye. I also found time to wonder if I had really seen all I'd surmised. Anger? Yes, that was possible, even likely. If she hadn't been angry with me, to at least some degree, she never would have left me in the first place, I supposed. But afraid? Why in God's name would Diane be afraid of me? I'd never laid a single finger on her. Yes, I suppose I had raised my voice during some of our arguments, but so had she. Mr. Davis, I'm Bill Humboldt, Diane's companion said. He held out a large hand that looked reddish and chapped. I shook it briefly. The rest of him was as big as his hand, and his broad face wore the sort of flush habitual drinkers often get after the first one of the day. I put him in his mid-40s, about 10 years away from the time when his sagging cheeks would turn into jowls. Pleasure, I said, not thinking about what I was saying any more than I was thinking about the maitre d' with the blob on his shirt, only wanting to get the handshaking part over so I could turn back to the pretty blonde with the rose and cream complexion, the pale pink lips, and the trim, slim figure. The woman who had, not so long ago, liked to whisper, "Do me, do me, do me," in my ear, while she held onto my ass like a saddle with two pommels. "Where is Mr. Ring?" Humboldt asked, looking around. A bit theatrically, I thought. "Mr. Ring is on his way to Long Island. His mother fell downstairs and broke her hip." "Oh, wonderful," Humboldt said. He picked up the half-finished martini in front of him on the table and drained it until the olive with the toothpick in it rested against his lips. He spat it back, then set the glass down and looked at me. "And I bet I can guess what he told you." I heard this, but paid no attention. For the time being, Humboldt was no more important than minor static on a radio program you really want to hear. I looked at Diane instead. It was marvelous, really, how she looked smarter and prettier than previous. As if she had learned things, yes, even after only 2 weeks of separation and while living with Ernie and Dee Dee Coslaw in Pound Ridge, that I could never know. "How are you, Steve?" she asked. "Fine," I said. Then, "Not so fine, actually. I've missed you." Only watchful silence from the lady greeted this, those big blue-green eyes looking at me, no more. Certainly no return serve, no, "I've missed you, too." "And I've quit smoking. That's also played hell with my peace of mind." "Did you finally? Good for you." I felt another flash of anger, this time a really ugly one, at her politely dismissive tone. As if I might not be telling the truth, but it didn't really matter if I was. She'd carped at me about the cigarettes every day for 2 years, it seemed. How they were going to give me cancer. How they were going to give her cancer. How she wouldn't even consider getting pregnant until I stopped. So I could just save any breath I might have been planning to waste on that subject. And now, all at once, it didn't matter anymore, because I didn't matter anymore. "We have a little business to transact," Humboldt said, "if you don't mind, that is." There was one of those big, boxy lawyer suitcases on the floor beside him. He picked it up with a grunt and set it on the chair where my lawyer would have been if his mother hadn't broken her hip. Humboldt began unsnapping the clasps, but I quit paying attention at that point. The fact was, I did mind. It wasn't a matter of caution, either. It was a matter of priorities. I felt an instant's gratitude that Ring had been called away. It certainly clarified the issues. I looked at Diane and said, "I want to try again. Can we reconcile? Is there any chance of that?" The look of absolute horror on her face crashed hopes I hadn't even known I'd been holding on to. Instead of answering, she looked past me at Humboldt. "You said we didn't have to talk about this." Her voice was trembling, accusatory. "You said you wouldn't even let it come up." Humboldt looked a little flustered. He shrugged and glanced briefly down at his empty martini glass before looking back up at Diane. I think he was wishing he'd ordered a double. "I didn't know Mr. Davis would be attending this meeting without his lawyer. You should have called me, Mr. Davis. Since you did not, I feel it necessary to inform you that Diane did not greenlight this meeting with any thoughts of reconciliation in mind. Her decision to seek a divorce is final." He glanced at her briefly, seeking confirmation, and got it. She was nodding emphatically. Her cheeks were considerably brighter than they had been when I sat down, and it was not the sort of flush I associate with embarrassment. "You bet it is," she said, and I saw that furious look on her face again. "Diane, why?" I hated the plaintive note I heard in my voice, a sound almost like a sheep's bleat, but there wasn't a goddamn thing I could do about it. "Why?" "Oh, Jesus," she said, "are you telling me you really don't know?" "Yes." Her cheeks were brighter than ever, the flush now rising almost to her temples. "No, probably you don't. Isn't that typical?" She picked up her water and spilled the top 2 inches on the tablecloth because her hand was trembling. I flashed back at once, I mean kapow, to the day she'd left, remembering how I'd knocked the glass of orange juice onto the floor and how I'd cautioned myself not to try picking up the broken pieces of glass until my hands had settled down, and how I'd gone ahead anyway and cut myself for my pains. "Stop it. This is counterproductive," Humboldt said. He sounded like a playground monitor trying to stop a scuffle before it gets started, but his eyes were sweeping the rear part of the room, looking for our waiter, or any waiter whose eye he could catch. He was a lot less interested in us at that particular moment than he was in obtaining what the British like to call the other half. "I just want to know," I began. "What you want to know doesn't have anything to do with why we're here," Humboldt said. And for a moment he sounded as sharp and alert as he probably had been when he first strode out of law school with his diploma in his hand. "Yes, right, finally," Diane said. She spoke in a brittle, urgent voice. "Finally, it's not about what you want, what you need." "I don't know what that means, but I'm willing to listen," I said. "We could try counseling. I'm not against it if maybe..." She raised her hands to shoulder level, palms out. "Oh, God, Mr. Macho's gone New Age." Then she dropped her hands back into her lap. "After all the days you rode off into the sunset, tall in the saddle. Say it ain't so, Joe." "Stop it," Humboldt told her. He looked from his client to his client's soon-to-be ex-husband. It was going to happen, all right. Even the slight unreality that comes with not smoking couldn't conceal that self-evident truth from me by that point. "One more word from either of you, and I'm going to declare this luncheon at an end." He gave us a small smile, one so obviously manufactured that I found it perversely endearing. "And we haven't even heard the specials yet." That, the first mention of food since I joined them, was just before the bad things started to happen, and I remember smelling salmon from one of the nearby tables. In the 2 weeks since I'd quit smoking, my sense of smell had become incredibly sharp, but I do not count that as much of a blessing, especially when it comes to salmon. I used to like it, but now I can't abide the smell of it, let alone the taste. To me, it smells of pain and fear and blood and death. "He started it," Diane said sulkily. "You started it. You were the one who walked out," I thought, but I kept it to myself. Humboldt clearly meant what he said. He would take Diane by the hand and walk her out of the restaurant if we started that schoolyard. "No, I didn't. Yes, you did. Shit." Not even the prospect of another drink would hold him here. "Okay," I said mildly, and I had to work hard to achieve that mild tone, believe me. "I started it. What's next?" I knew, of course. Papers, papers, papers. And probably the only satisfaction I was going to get out of this sorry situation was telling them that I wasn't going to sign any, or even look at any, on the advice of my lawyer. I glanced at Diane again, but she was looking down at her empty plate, and her hair hid her face. I felt a strong urge to grab her by the shoulders and shake her inside her new blue dress like a pebble inside of a gourd. "Do you think you're in this alone?" I would shout at her. "Do you think you're in this alone? Well, the Marlboro man has got news for you, sweetheart. You're a stubborn, self-indulgent little bit." "Mr. Davis?" Humboldt asked politely. I looked around at him. "There you are," he said. "I thought we'd lost you again." "Not at all," I said. "Good. Lovely." He had several sheafs of paper in his hands. They were held together by those paper clips that come in different colors, red, blue, yellow, purple. They went well with the impressionist drawings on the walls of the Gotham Cafe. It occurred to me that I had come abysmally unprepared for this meeting, and not just because my lawyer was on the 1224 to Babylon, either. Diane had her new dress. Humboldt had his Brinks truck of a briefcase, plus documents held together by color-coded paper clips. All I had was my new umbrella on a sunny day. I looked down at where it lay beside my chair, it never crossed my mind to check it, and saw there was still a price tag dangling from the handle. All at once, I felt like Minnie Pearl,